Shall we play a game?
What is with meat space?
You didn't say the magic word.
The files are in the computer?
We're only using a simple polyphonetically grouped 20-square digit key transpose from booster phonic form with multiple nulls.
After very careful consideration, sir, I've come to the conclusion that your new defense system sucks.
So the combination is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
So it's a code breaker. No, it's the code breaker.
Welcome to the Cyber Tap. Mike, how in the world are you?
I don't know. I might be having a mental breakdown because it sure feels like I'm back in December and January right now.
Yeah, it's an April snowmageddon across the Midwest. It was like hitting 70. All the flowers are blooming. The birds are chirping. And yeah, there's snow covering the ground today. So thanks for that weather. Global cooling,
I do have a hankering
warming,
for sushi,
change.
Though. I got to tell you.
You do?
I'm feeling sushi. Yeah, I don't know why.
Why are you feeling sushi, Mike?
I don't know. Maybe it's mental epiphany.
Are you trying to tee up the transition for me this time?
Very unsuccessfully.
Well, I'm going to take the bait, Mike. So today's episode, we had a really fun conversation with Dr. Eric Cole. So we're getting to know Eric on this episode, and he tells a really good story about how he liked to have sushi with John McAfee. And so I think you'll enjoy this one. And with that, this is the Cyber Tap with Dr. Eric Cole. Well, Dr. Eric Cole, is it okay if I just call you Eric?
Perfect. Yeah, I've been called a lot of things, so Eric's probably one of the nicest things I've been called today.
Okay, I was going to say Mr. Dr. Eric Cole, just to be as awkward as possible. Eric, thanks for joining the Cyber Tap today. It's great to have you on, and it's good to meet you.
My pleasure to meet you, and especially, like I said, my son goes to Purdue, so boiler up.
Yeah, well, boiler up. We certainly appreciate that. You gained a lot of favor. I could tell you that by telling Mike and I you have a child here at Purdue. And even though he's in business, he should look up the Cyber Tap and look us up because we're right around the corner from him. And we have a lot of student engagement in our office. So if he has any interest in cybersecurity from a business perspective, hey, we need to have a conversation.
Sounds great.
So we were, like I said, it's good to meet you. We were joking a little bit before we started the chat today. You and I were at Lockheed at the same time, and we want to hear a little bit more about your background. But, and then I lived also in the same kind of geographical region that you're in today. And so this is two episodes in a row where I had a kind of our guest, we crossed paths geographically at the same time. So there's some kind of theme here. I don't know if Jim's setting this up for us or what, producer Jim, but it's working for us. But Eric, before kind of—
Wait, you didn't realize this is Matt? This is your life?
I know, it's something. I don't know. All right. So before we kind of get into the rest of the conversation, we always start these the same way, Eric. We would like to get to know you a little bit more and try to get a little bit of your background. So how'd you get started in cyber? And you can kind of take us the highlights of the career and up to what you're doing today.
So I've been working in cybersecurity for 30 years, and I've loved every minute of it. So I consider it an honor for what I do. I don't consider it a job, which I know sometimes drives my family crazy because people are like, what's your hobby? Cybersecurity. No, what do you do for fun? Cybersecurity. No, what do you do when you're not working? Cybersecurity, right? That's pretty much my life. So I grew up in New York, so you'll get a little bit of the Joey Buttafuoco accent when I get
Vinny
excited.
Vinny Mykozich.
Yeah, exactly. There we go.
Johnny Bag of Donuts.
Yep. So you'll notice when I do data and a few terms like that's a little off. But when I was growing up, I was fascinated by architecture, and that's what I really wanted to do. But a friend of the family said, hey, Eric, why don't you major in computers? This was in the early 80s, because everything's moving to computers, and then you can do whatever you want. So I majored in computer science. A year and a half in, I remember sitting there in a Fortran class, because back then it was basically electrical engineering with a couple of extra programming classes. And I'm like, is this what I want to do with my life? So something told me, I remember it was a Thursday afternoon, like it was yesterday, I must go to the co-op office today. And I go outside and it's raining. So the universe was testing me. And I walked a mile and a half to the co-op office, got there at about 4 o'clock. And they said, Eric, how did you know? I said, know what? They said, the CIA is recruiting on campus tomorrow, and there's one slot left if you would like it. So I took it, and finally, I was 19 years old. I finally, after 19 years, found an organization that loved the fact that I was boring and had no social life. I'd actually impressed them because you need that to get a clearance. So yeah, I was one of those very boring, weird kids. So I go to work for the CIA and I'm studying systems, and I ask a simple question in a big meeting: how do we know these systems are secure? And they go, Eric, thanks for volunteering to solve that problem. And I wasn't volunteering, I was just asking. And that took me on a journey, because as you know, with cybersecurity, there's no way to prove a system is secure. You can only prove it's not secure by breaking in. So that took me on an 8-year journey of being a professional hacker for the CIA, where essentially I was tasked with sort of breaking into systems anywhere, anyplace, anytime. And after doing that for 8 years, being a professional hacker for the government, I loved the job and I love working for the government, but I realized two things. One, offense is boring and easy because you always get in. So I switched to the defense.
Interesting.
And second, I don't like bureaucracies and having bosses. So I began my career as an entrepreneur. So from there, I bought and sold multiple companies, and that took me where I was chief scientist at Lockheed Martin, responsible for all their cybersecurity incidents. I was chief technology officer for McAfee. I also wrote a lot of cybersecurity classes, and now I'm running my own business, Secure Anchor.
I mean, that's a very interesting path, I would say, and one that I think a lot of young cybersecurity folks would want to emulate. So I'm gonna go back to the beginning. So you went from co-op to full-time, or intern to full-time, it sounds like, with the agency. And you said something I thought was really good. So your lack of interesting background and personality was a great fit for the CIA. When I also had a security clearance when I went out to work for Lockheed in DC. I had that boring background as well. So when they were doing my background investigation, I can remember, Mike, that the investigator called me and said, "Hey, I need more contacts. This is far too easy." And I said, "I've lived two places in my life, home with my parents for 18 years and one spot at Purdue. That's it. I can't make it more interesting." And so I told the background investigator,
you needed to have your parents give them more dirt on you. I mean,
well, you know, they got plenty. They went to my next door neighbor. I can remember this story. They went to my next door neighbor and they said, "How long have you known Matthew Tramsky?" And they said, "Well, I have known him since November, you know, of 1979. "Wait, that's when he was born." "Yeah, I've known him his whole life. He's got the same birthday as my son." And so the investigator had too easy of time. So I sent him to talk to another family friend. That family friend was like, "Well, I bowl on Friday nights." This is Indiana, folks. Okay. They're bowling on Friday nights. And he said, "I'll meet you at the Moose Club or the Moose Lodge after bowling." But he was late because bowling ran long. So the investigator sat there at the Moose Lodge and accidentally got drunk before the interview. True story. I won't say which agency was doing the investigation, but it was actually a military group. But yeah, those boring ones are kind of fun for them to do, I'm sure, because they don't have that much work in the background investigation. No close and continue foreign contacts, right? Continue foreign contacts, things like that makes it easy. Okay, so you spent some time with the agency. Is that kind of how you say you cut your teeth? What kind of technologies were you really focused on at that time?
Yes. So it's sort of across the board. So, and once again, I'm dating myself, but I did some of the initial security penetration testing and tech eval when Windows NT was still in beta. Nice. So did a lot of Windows NT, also a lot of mainframes. Linux was just sort of coming out mid-career when I was at the agency, and a lot of routers and switches and networking. And one thing I will tell folks is, if you're looking to get started in cybersecurity, putting in 6 to 10 years in government or military is probably the best investment you can make, because they let you play and they give you a lot of toys. So my budget that I had every year to buy toys was 4 times my salary. So they wouldn't give me money, yeah, but they would give me budget so I could buy it. So I had like a room with just every possible configuration, and we can just reconfigure and reset up. And that's probably what got me to where I am today, because I just was able to delve in and just learn so much about tech and have access to tech I would not have been able to get anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. So are you doing less of the technical work today in your career?
Yes, it's one of those where probably About 3 or 4 years ago, I had an epiphany, and I get those periodically, and it's always quite scary. And what I always thought was the reason why organizations were getting compromised is because they didn't have good technical people, that mm-hmm. the technical people weren't properly trained. And that's why early in my career, I've written so many books on technology, technical focused on cybersecurity, network security Bible. I created classes because I felt we needed to have a robust technical cadre of people that can solve the problem. But about a couple of years ago, I realized the fundamental problem with organizations and getting breached is that executives don't understand cybersecurity and cybersecurity people don't speak English. So the two weren't communicating. And so what I'm focused now on is what is truly a chief information security officer mm-hmm. and how do you train them up? So I'm really training up and getting people that can speak both languages, because we have this misnomer in the industry that a chief information security officer or a CISO is really a technical career path. If you work at a company for 12 years and you're an Uber geek, you become a CISO. And that's what the model fails, because a CISO is a business position that must speak mm-hmm. to the executives. And if you're too technical, the executives aren't going to listen or respect what you say.
And but on the counter, if you're not technical enough, your team won't respect you either. So it's really a position of translation.
Exactly. What I call it is you're a marriage counselor, because you have the executives that speak one language, you have the techies that speak another, and they don't get along. They just talk past each other. And the CISO has to speak both to translate back and forth and make sure everyone gets along nicely.
So was it better to start then technical for that path and transition to business? Start business, transition to technical, or start with neither and then just get thrown in the position?
I'm of course biased because of my background, but I believe that you need to understand cyber, and that has to be the foundation. So 3 to 5 years, and then from there you can learn the business and understand how that works. Now I have had some clients where their business, and I can teach them the cyber, but I find having the technical mindset and moving up the strategy is usually easier than somebody who's a very strategic thinker and trying to get them to drill down into technical and tactics.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I in my experience, the most CISOs that I've interacted with are executive level technology folks, CTOs, CIOs, CISOs, those types of folks usually have started on the technical path early and just outgrown or you know, as they matured, maybe I think I want to do more strategy. I think I want to be a, you know, maybe they're a blue sky early in their career and they like to think the big picture already and have no way to implement. And so they kind of grow into those positions, though, at least the ones that I know that have been successful. We've talked to so many great cyber minds on this podcast. It seems like that's a pretty common path.
Yeah. And to me, the big thing is you have to make that shift. There's nothing wrong with being a world-class security engineer. I have friends of mine that are world-class security engineers and they make tons and tons of money. But if you want to be a world-class security engineer, don't try to go for the CISO title, because yeah. you're just going to get frustrated and everyone around you is going to get frustrated. So if you decide that, okay, I want to switch, I want to think business, I want to think strategy, and you mentally shift and become a CISO, that's awesome. And the background serves you well. But way too often, I just see people say, I'm going to stay the technical career path and just give me a cool title. And that's, to me, when it gets disastrous and ineffective.
Yeah. And I think the DC metro area where you're based out of is really one that enables people to go back and forth to in between those positions. I know there for me, I could switch whenever I'd switch jobs, which is often in the DC metro. There's a lot of movement in that area, especially, you know, from contractor to contractor, position to position or whatever. You could go from technical to management, get, you know, if you got bored with that a little bit, go back to technical. And it was never considered, you know, up or down. It was almost always lateral because the technical, you know, was so prized there, especially for some of those contracting groups that were supporting the TLAs, right? The three-letter agencies and places like that. That was what I enjoyed probably most about DC, being able to jump from those place to place, grow at the same time. But then you can make a decision. I'm going to switch to, I was a GD and a program manager, and then I took a technical job working in the Department of Defense, now at the Pentagon, because it was a cool job. I didn't have to worry about making less money. I didn't have to worry about it being a, you know, a demotion in any way. No, it was actually, you know, financially, it was a better opportunity, even though it was, you know, no management required for that one, which was good. Yeah, I like that about the DC area for sure. Lots of opportunity there. So, Eric, you mentioned another stop along the way, and I got to ask a question. When you were at McAfee, what years was that?
I was there from 2008 to about 2012 through the acquisition. Okay. So I was actually brought in by Dave DeWalt because he wanted to reposition and sell the company, but the technology wasn't aligned with what the customers wanted. So mm-hmm. I sort of realigned the portfolio. He gave me a 7-year runway, and we did it in 5 years, was able to capture the intellectual property in a way to sell to Intel. But yeah, sort of what I always joke with people is I got to meet John McAfee a few times.
That was my question. You literally anticipated where I was yeah. going.
Everyone goes there. And I'll tell you, all the reports that you see about him and hear on the news of being crazy and mentally unstable are grossly, grossly underreported. The dude is brilliant, but the dude is crazy, man. The dude is like, he lives on a Planet John population one. And the joke, but it's serious, is whenever John would come into town, he would always say, "Eric, let's go out to dinner." Because me and him got along, like we would geek out and talk business and really sort of was kindred souls, except I like to think I'm a little less crazy, but that might not be true. And he would always say, "Eric, pick where you want to go." And I would always consciously pick sushi restaurants. And finally, after about 5 or 6 times, John's like, "Eric, do you eat anything else other than sushi?" I said, "Absolutely." He goes, "Why do you only pick sushi restaurants?" And at that point, I felt like I knew him pretty well. And I said, "John, can I be honest with you?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "I love you and you're great, but I think you're a little mentally unstable. And if I go to a steakhouse with you and you have a sharp knife, if I say the wrong thing, you might kill me. Death by chopsticks is a safer way to go." And he looks at me and it was like that awkward pause. I'm like, "Is this going to go bad?" And he's like, "Eric, that's probably one of the smartest things I ever heard anybody say." I'm like, "All right, we got out of that one." But that honestly was the reason, because I'm like, what's the safest restaurant that he can do the less damage? And I'm like, chopsticks are pretty safe.
I don't know. He's probably, next time you do that, he's going to be filing a chopstick.
I know, he's going to be a ninja.
Like a prison shiv. He's like, he's over there filing it to a point. You're never going
to. What secrets are more damning to your career, the 8 years you spent at the government or the one night spin out with John?
Yeah. I was going to say, chances are probably getting arrested or kidnapped by terrorists. It was probably the time with John that put me at higher risk. So
I'll tell you, the brilliance also, you know, oftentimes comes with some eccentricities, right? So if you're, and I know, like, I was watching, you know, podcast with Elon Musk, and he's a really interesting guy. I just feel like they're probably not that different, but he might do less cocaine, frankly. Or whatever John McAfee's poison is in real life. We hear all the stories, right? But, oh, man.
It's like they always said, and I truly believe it, there's a fine line between brilliance and insanity. Yeah. And the question is just how long you live in each of those worlds. And yeah, I do think it comes down to, unfortunately, most of these brilliant people do tend to like to play with interesting substances, shall we call it. And I guess it's just which one you pick and how long.
yeah, I don't know. That's a world which I know very, very little about, either because I'm not brilliant or because I just, and oh my gosh, Eric said we are recording this on 420. I think this is probably so technician Eric, not Eric Cole, the guest. Yeah, you're right, Eric. It is 420, and we're recording it, and I didn't even think about that. And this is probably the first time we've ever talked about drugs, or the first time I've said cocaine on the podcast.
Excellent. So my first show and you bring up drugs. Awesome. My son will be so proud.
He will. So you went from sushi parties with John McAfee, and again, we understand you were just having dinner. No one's accusing you of illicit
dinner. Drugs. You got to put the quotes. This is where we need video. Dinner.
You were having dinner with John McAfee, but then it looks like you went over to Sands, during that time as well. That's a serious organization. Not so much partying, probably there. What's that like? How's that been? Or, I mean, you see that you spent quite a bit of time with him.
Yeah. So that was one that was sort of a parallel path. So in early 2000, I got involved with Sands, and it was still a very small organization. At the time, they had like five or six courses and pretty small. And I came in and built out their cyber defense curriculum and ended up billing their most popular course, Security Essentials, that at least up until the time I left was still their number one selling course. And yeah, it was a great organization. And that's when I really found what I think one of my purposes and callings is really to teach and help people. And I believe everyone's sort of put on the planet with a unique skill set. And to me, it's really to make cyberspace a safe place to live, work, and raise a family, which requires teaching, education, and helping people. So yeah, I just love that time. I'm the opposite of most people. Is if you put me like at a cocktail party where you're one-on-one and you have to walk around and mingle, I am so uncomfortable and nervous. I'm like, get me out of there as quick as possible. I am just, I can't stand it. But you put me on stage in front of 3,000 people, and it's like go time. I mean, I just love it. There's no fear, no anxiety. I just have a blast and I just go to town. So it's one of those where I'm just wired a little differently, where when I see a bunch of people show up that want to learn and I'm there to teach them, to me, it's a humbling experience. And I just sort of get in my mojo and go to town. So yeah, I worked for Sands for about 18 years. And then it was one of those things where it was just sort of time. I'm a builder. I'm not a maintainer. So once a lot of the curriculum was built and everything was set up, to me, it was sort of time to hand the baton off to some other amazing people to sort of run with it, stabilize, maintain it. And then I sort of move on to my next adventure of building another company and making a difference in the world.
And so that's where what you're doing now. You do have a company you're building. Is that fair? Or kind of what are you doing with Secure Anchor in the consulting, and where do you want to go with that company?
Yeah, so with Secure Anchor, I'm building that up, and we have three product lines, but it's really all focused on security awareness, strategy, and roadmaps. So we go in and have a CISO certification where we can train up CISOs. We also have a vCISO where we can actually put someone in the organization to help them build out that strategy. And then we have an assessment business that will evaluate, analyze, and build out that security roadmap for the organization. So that's what we're really building up. And once again, looking to build that up to about 30, 40 million, get some key products in there with a multiplier, and then sort of do one more exit. Because heck, you could always have another sports car, right? There's you always need another garage. And I love my toys. I joke with my son that the only difference between a 15 or 21 year old and a 51 year old is you just get more expensive toys as you grow up. So
yeah, the hobbies get more expensive for sure. That's for sure.
I also see on your bio, at least on the Secure Anchor site, that you have expert witness as one of your service lines. And we've had some legal areas that we've discussed on this podcast as it deals with cybersecurity. But I'm curious what your experience is, what you can talk about, what you can't talk about.
Yes. Yeah, so that's sort of, and thanks for bringing that up, because that was the third one that's sort of a little bit of an anomaly, but that's I really enjoy that. So in high profile cases, they bring in experts to testify. And essentially, you have to sit there in front of a non-technical jury or a 73-year-old judge and explain router switches, packets, and TCP/IP to them. So to me, once again, that teaching component of really explaining things that are very, very, very complex in simple terms, so non-technical people can understand it, is once again something I enjoy. So I've worked on patent litigation cases. I've worked on big breaches. I've worked on the T-Mobile breach, the Marriott breach, a couple of cases with the FTC. Probably one of my big things last year was with the epidemic. I actually testified in the first 100% virtual trial within the United States. That was a bench trial. And if that was not big enough, it also got the largest verdict ever, which was a $2.3 billion verdict for our clients. So that was sort of like a double big win for us. But yeah, that's something that whenever I get business coaches or strategists, they look at my business, they're like, yeah, Eric, if you really want to grow, you got to be single focused and you got to get rid of expert witness and you got to stop focusing on that. And I'm like, but I enjoy it and have so much fun. And to me, you can always make money. It's about living life, having fun, and doing what you enjoy. So I'm like, yeah, thanks for the advice, but I'm going to keep doing it. So it's just sort of one of those fun things. And plus, it uses a different part of my brain So it lets me actually operate at a high level, but switch gears. So I work on expert witness for a couple of hours, burn out that side of the brain. I then work on security assessments and podcasts, burn out the other side, and hopefully the regenerate, and I can sort of flip-flop back and forth.
Yeah, we had.
Did they actually use phrases like badgering the witness and any of that stuff, or is that all just TV?
That typically happens more in deposition. So I'll give you the quick rundown. So you write an expert report and you give it to the other side. Then within 30 days, they get to do a deposition. And I'll tell you right now, anybody who says they love depositions are either mentally insane or on heavy amounts of drugs, because you're the only one in the room that's not an attorney. The opposing counsel basically drills you for 7 hours on the record, which means it's about a 10-hour day with breaks. And the only purpose of the deposition is for you to say things wrong so they can use it against you in court. So in those cases during depositions, because there's no judge and no jury, and they're going to only use the pieces they want, it will sometimes get very heated. Like they'll start in there, Dr. Cole, are you not capable of answering? And then the opposing attorney would be like, stop badgering the witness. So yeah, it does. So that's more than TV. Now in the courtroom, they tend to be a little more behaved because there's a judge and a jury there. So more often than not, they're going to object like to add a scope or inappropriate or things like that. But yeah, the depositions get pretty hairy.
We had Dr. Marcus Rogers, who's a faculty member here at Purdue, and he runs the high tech crime unit. And he has expert witness expertise. So Mike was alluding to him being on the show a few weeks ago, and we talked a lot about this. And he had mentioned that for criminal cases and various cases, he's been both expert witness for the defense and the prosecution. So I think that's all. It's whoever asks first, I think, was his. You know, like we'll do it.
Pays more.
Yeah, maybe. Now, have you you mentioned a lot of stuff like civil lawsuits and for breaches and things like that. Have you done some criminal cases as well?
Yeah, I've done a few criminal cases. Most of the cases I work on tend to be on civil side, are either breach, gross negligence, or I do a lot of patent litigation, patent infringement. And I do a little work for the defendant, but most of my work is on the plaintiff side. So I tend to focus more on the plaintiffs. And what I always jokingly say is if you work for the defendant, there's really no win for them. Because if a defendant wins, it basically means they don't have to pay a lot of money, but they don't get any benefit. If you do for the plaintiff and they win, they get $2 billion. So I tend, but when you work for the plaintiff, you tend to have much happier clients if you do your job correctly, because there's a much bigger payoff.
Yeah, sure. I can certainly see that. I always, I love to argue. So maybe I should try this job someday, Mike.
You'd be better on the lawyer side, because unfortunately, experts, you really can't argue too much. You have to you'd be like, bring it, man. Come on.
You're leading the witness. You are the witness.
Wait, I am what? The Yeah, I object, Your Honor. You can't object. You're the witness. I object anyway. Oh, okay. Yeah, that would be fun. Good find on the bio on that one, Mike. I like that. I missed that when I was looking through your stuff. So you mentioned, Eric, obviously you've written quite a few books. So along your career, where do these books start to pop up? So you mentioned like the Network Security Bible and some of the other ones. Like when do you write your first book, and kind of take us through your author career and parallel it to your kind of industry career?
So it was sort of similar to I left the agency and started working commercial and sort of be in leadership positions. And about that time is when I started teaching for SANS. And as I started building out the courseware, I also wanted to help people that couldn't necessarily afford the courses. And SANS fully supports that. So I started writing books in early 2000. So my first book, which is actually Hackers Beware, but funny story is before Hackers was in the dictionary, because this was in early 2001, it auto-corrected. So when I gave one of my first keynotes in 2003, this was the introduction. Please welcome Eric Cole, who is the author of a new book, Hookers Beware. And I'm like, really? Did you just do that? Yeah, so they auto-corrected on the bio sheet from Hackers to Hookers.
Co-authored by John McAfee.
Exactly. And nobody caught that. So yes, that's sort of the joke that a lot of my colleagues have. So my first book is technically Hackers Beware, but the second edition could be Hookers Beware. And then I also wrote Advanced Persistent Threat and had a little geek out session with steganography when I was working on my PhD. So I wrote Hiding in Plain Sight, which I think 18 people bought, or maybe 19, because it was such a narrow topic. But it was with my dissertation, and dissertations, the way you protect it is by publishing. So that was one of my ways to protect. Then I got a really good deal and honored with Riley to actually, they have their Bible series. So I was actually the author of Network Security Bible, first edition and second edition. That was probably at the time the best-selling book I had. And then after that, I started switching. So about 5 years ago, I said, okay, I want to help parents, teachers, non-technical. So I wrote Online Danger that did really well. And then last year, I really want to write a book for executives so they can understand cyber without any geek terms. So I wrote Cyber Crisis, which comes out in about a month. And that one was probably the biggest labor of love, because I would write a chapter and send it to five CEOs, different ones, because you can only get so much. And if they came back and all five of them gave thumbs up, I said, great. If anyone commented, didn't like it, or gave critiques, I rewrote it. So every chapter got rewritten about three or four times, but I wanted to get to the point where it was at the executive level that CEOs respect. And finally, at the end of the process, I believe I got there.
So I'm sure all your books are like children. You love them all the same. But if I'll admit, I haven't read any of your books yet. Ooh, I should probably have gotten one before this call. Which one should I start with? Should I wait for Cyber Crisis in a month, or should I give another one a read? I mean, obviously they're a little different intended off audiences, but what's the go-to one?
So if you want to, so to me, the way it works is the latest is always your favorite. So, so Cyber Crisis is always my favorite, because you always think you get better. So I would generically, across the board, without any caveats, I would say Cyber Crisis. Now the caveat would be is if you wanted to get more into business and strategy and CISO, then definitely Cyber Crisis. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to go in and probably help what I think is the biggest need, which is people that get targeted the most by cyber attacks are people over 60. Mm. That's basically grandma, grandpa, yeah, nana, aunts, and uncles. So if you want to help them, which I believe there's a huge need, I would say Online Danger. Or if you just wanted to get into cybersecurity, like when I do a lot of volunteer work at the high schools, because I think we need a lot more people and a lot more diversity in cybersecurity, so I volunteer a lot, is Network Security Bible, because that's sort of still accurate. Being honest, hackers beware. Like, that was published in 2001 and people still buy it. And I'm like, really? I mean, you might as well buy a history book, right? Because I mean, the stuff's so old in it. But I'm like, okay, I still get my $20 royalty check. So I guess there's four crazy people out there every month that still buy it.
Fair enough. I was looking at that Online Danger book. What are some of the highlights from that one? I like the concept, right? Because you know, at Purdue, we're in a mission also to help people be more secure, whether that's individuals or businesses. Our group, CyberTap, focuses more on the business side, but you know, through that we do a lot of awareness work, and we, you know, even on this podcast we had Jim Browning on, who does Scam the Scammer on YouTube. I don't know if you've ever come across Jim Browning videos. Really interesting, fun conversation with him. But you're right, it's like our grandmothers and now my parents that are, you know, the vulnerable targets. And so that Online Danger book, what's the highlights from that one for you?
So a couple of key highlights. The first one is, I don't care who you are, what you do, or how much money you have in the bank, you are a target. You need to recognize you are a target, and cybersecurity is your responsibility. Second is, you are your biggest enemy. Where we use mobile devices. Your mobile device is spying on you, and it's because you allowed it. It's because you went in and downloaded some app from a foreign country And when you went to run it the first time, it says, can we access your mic? Can we access your camera? And you thought it was a good idea to say yes, 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 yes. And then it's recording, monitoring, and tracking everything you are doing. So you just need to be, cybersecurity is not hard. It's just about awareness and controlling and managing what you do. Mm. And then probably the biggest message, especially with what's happening now with teenagers, high school and college students, is you are being monitored. Your life is being recorded. Anything you say can and will be used against you. And there is no delete button. Yeah. So you need to be so careful. Last year, we saw such a surge where people that got accepted to colleges on scholarships because of something they did 4 or 5 years ago, or in many cases, a TikTok video they did where they copied somebody else's lyrics.
Right.
Because there happened to be a certain word in the lyric that they sang directly word for word, they're getting kicked out of college. They're getting their scholarships revoked. Their lives are being destroyed. Now, once again, not here to justify one way or another, but at some point we have to back up and say, kids need to be kids and we need to let them to be able to make mistakes. I joke, if I was growing up in this day and age where there were cell phones and everything recorded, I would have been in jail a dozen times. I mean, I did stupid things when I was a teenager and you're
there
supposed to.
There are Polaroids still floating around that
I'm sure there are.
Yeah, Mike and I are roughly the same age, and I think about that all the time. My wife and I have that conversation all the time because we were at Purdue at the same time. If every single person had a camera in their pocket when we were 18 to 24 year olds, it'd be mortifying what would be in the public sphere, you know, especially 20, 30 years later. But yeah, I understand your point. You're not here to make a commentary on whether or not a student should be a scholarship removed or enrollment should be denied because of something they said. But the truth of the matter is, it's out there. And once it's out there in the digital, in cyberspace, in the digital realm, it's out there. That's the threat. That's the interesting aspect of it.
And to me, it's a society and parental guidance thing where I'm sure if you told those kids, listen, if you go in and start doing these silly videos and you do one silly video and you won't be able to get into college, is that worth it? Yeah. Even a 15-year-old smart enough to say probably not. But here's the problem. When our kids are 4 and 5 years old, we sit down with them and talk about physical dangers. Sure. We tell them, don't take candy from strangers. Don't get in a car. I remember my youngest when she was in kindergarten and I used to pick her up from the school and I would get out to give her a hug. She would scream, stranger danger, stranger. And the principal and the police would, and I'd be like, honey, you can't do that. It's not funny. And daddy will get arrested. And I kid you not, at 5 years old, she looks at me and goes, dad, if you got arrested, it would be hysterical for me, not so much for you. And I'm like,
yeah, I love your daughter already.
I said, and she's now 16 and she is awesome. But we do all this training. Then when they're whatever age, it depends on the generation, they're 8, 10 or 12. We go, here you go. And we hand them a device that they know more than we do. And we give them zero training. Yeah. We give them zero awareness and we give them zero updates. So to me, we really, as parents, society, schooling, need to do a better job of educating individuals of what the dangers are that out there. Just so we're clear, it's not kids. I have three of them, so that's near and dear. But I know adults that are not getting jobs or getting fired from jobs because of something they said or did on social media. And one of the number one requests I get is, Eric, how do you permanently delete something from social media? And I basically say, you don't, right? I can go in and minimize, reduce it. I can do things so it shows up 6 layers on your search page. But once it's out there and you can delete it from the local platform, but it's still accessible, it's still stored, and it's still searchable by anybody that wants to find it.
Yeah, not to mention who scraped it.
Yes.
And is purposefully keeping things in perpetuity. I mean, that's what I think about with my kids, right? So I remember my daughter when she's 15 and she got Snapchat. I'm thinking, okay, just because it says it's deleted, it's not deleted. And I know what it says if they've taken a screen cap of it or whatever. I'm like, well, they could take a photo of it with another phone. Like there's a million ways to capture exactly what you left there. So don't leave them anything to capture. That's the key. Yeah. It's kind of an interesting world. So that online danger book, I think, I'm gonna I'm gonna have to take a good look at that one. And I'm interested in this crisis one too that's coming out. So tell us, so you said this is kind of the CISO training, speaking executive level cybersecurity. Tell us a little bit more about the highlights on this one coming out.
Yes. Yeah, so the tagline of Cyber Crisis is protecting your business from real threats in the virtual world. But it really applies to everyone. Because the way that I always explain it is, if you're a mom or a dad, you're running a business. It's called your house. If you're a teacher, you're running a business called the classroom. So to me, it's really meant to be a very non-technical, pragmatic guide focusing on business language of what executives need to know in order to make proper decisions to protect their organization. But the same exact advice and decisions an executive's going to make applies to just about anyone. But what's interesting is, we started doing pre-release versions of it. And while my intent was for managers, directors, and business folks, I'm finding a lot of security people are reading it to say, oh, this is how I talk to executives. Right. This is the language I need to utilize, because so many technical people, they don't even realize how geeky they really are, right? They'll go into an executive meeting and they think they crushed it. And they're talking about packets and payloads and IDS and firewalls and IPS and everything else. Services, so they don't even realize how techie. Yeah. So this book is also a good guide that if you want to be very, very, very effective, then you need to learn the language. Because one thing I've learned throughout my life is all problems and all solutions are created through communication. If you have a problem with anybody, any individual in any situation, it's always a communication problem. And the way you fix it is by understanding and speaking the communication language. And then the other thing I also learned with being married for 25 years, that all problems with communication are also my fault. So that's sort of bonus.
So are these techniques that you've got in this book stuff that you've acquired in your own personal experiences? Or did you have to interview maybe some other people on what techniques they've used?
I would say yes. And the reason I'm hesitating is the intent of writing the book was really based on my knowledge, my experience, and what I've learned to work over the years. However, that would be such a naive view for me to have, because all of my opinions, experience, and knowledge is because of the great mentorship, executives, and other people that I've run across. So I would say inadvertently, all my experience came through interviews, knowledge, and people helping me. But when I sat down to write it, it really came from the experience. I didn't actually interview folks. And by the way, it's scary. You're inside my mind, because that's my next book where I want to write How Do Executives Think About Cybersecurity and interview like 10 or 12 executives. So you're spot on with where I'm going with my thinking.
So either I've got that epiphany going on too, or maybe the chips the government put in my brain is finally turned on.
Maybe.
At this point, the fact that you're thinking like me, you should be very, very scared and afraid. But
well, end up in a sushi restaurant with my
dad. Exactly. Go to, only sushi now. Don't go to steakhouses anymore.
Well, Mike and I are both 50% of the way into our COVID vaccine, so we've got that first dose of government's chips inside, so our 5G is strong right now.
Oh, yeah. I'm with you. If you want to hear a funny story, is like most people, I've done my own research. And just because it was more of a true vaccine, I was a very big fan of the Johnson & Johnson. So I'm like telling everyone, you got to do Johnson & Johnson. You got to do Johnson. And then it finally came out in the area. So I get the Johnson & Johnson one on a Monday afternoon. And then Tuesday morning, they basically pull it off the market because it's killing everybody. I'm like, wonderful. Yeah. And so my kids just think this is the most hysterical thing on the planet. They're like, yeah, Dad, we should really listen to your advice. So,
So kids will definitely let you hear it. Now, mine wasn't vaccine related, but my daughter yesterday, I think, no, 2 days ago, we're sitting at dinner and I had to eat some crow because I bought something off of a fairly shady website, and Mike will tell you, I'll do that on occasion. I try to be fairly calculated, right? Yeah. Now, they offered PayPal, so I paid via PayPal, and so I got my money back. But yes, it was a bit of a scam. I'm trying to get something drop shipped straight from overseas. You know how it is.
And I'm insight like, into Matt's brain. Can I save 10 cents? If I can, I'm doing it.
10 cents. It was more. Yeah, I'm cheap. But yeah, my daughter, so we're sitting there, and my daughter out of nowhere goes, heard you got scammed. I was looking at my wife. I'm like, why'd you tell her? And she goes, you always tell us to not do that and be careful. And I was like, well, I took a calculated risk. I knew I'd get my money back, but yeah, so I got it. So yeah, anytime we make bad advice to other people, I know my kids go, let me hear about it for sure.
Oh, yeah, they're going to make sure we pay for it.
Especially if it's cybersecurity related. Yeah. Now I will say this about my daughter. She's got a Chromebook. Our schools issue the Chromebooks or whatever. And I went into her room and she was working on her Chromebook and I looked up and she had put duct tape over her camera. I didn't tell her to do that. I've tried to, beat this stuff into her head for years about being secure. And I was like, I can get you a slide. She goes, the duct tape works fine. So that was proud dad moment for two reasons. She's cheap and used duct tape. So that made me proud. And then two, she actually covered her camera because she goes, I didn't want it to come on even accidentally when I'm in my bedroom. Even if it's, not thinking about necessarily a nefarious actor, but just a Zoom call she forgot to shut off or whatever. And then she forgot that, didn't put pants on or something. We've seen those videos or people take their laptop to the bathroom and go pee with them. Like, oh boy, that's just, yeah. Anyway, that's my proud parent moment. But yeah, I understand. My kids will come after me too as soon as I say something that doesn't pan out like I hope to.
And now with you saying that, I'm actually real glad we're not doing video because I didn't know we're supposed to wear pants for this. So
audio only. We can see
audio only. Exactly. Yeah, audio pants only. Are optional.
Well, sometimes I'm in my basement in sweats when we do this. I usually always definitely have pants, but that's a different story.
No, funny story with that, with the expert witness. So I wear a shirt and a jacket and a tie for depots and everything else, but I just wear sweatpants. I don't actually put on my suit pants. So I know the jackets still fit. But then about 4 weeks ago, I had to go to a hearing, one of the first ones, and I pack my suit and I get there that morning. I kid you not, my pants don't fit. I'm like, oh crap. I'm like, but what do I do now? So I'm like jury rigging with the belt to get them on. I'm like, so lessons learned of COVID, check your pants periodically.
Good advice. And also when you first have to put them on, it's not good. I mean,
it's not going to end well.
Yeah, absolutely. I was doing good at the beginning of COVID. I was dropping weight, exercising, and then the holidays and this, forget about it. Somebody said, I heard you dropped a bunch of weight. And I was like, I found it. It was on the ground. I picked it all up, put it back on, added a little bit more. So that'll happen. Now, Eric, you mentioned your next book is going to be this look into the mind of a CEO or executive as it relates to cyber. What else is on the horizon for you other than that book? Anything else you're kind of working towards or thinking about? Crystal ball time.
Yeah, but probably the big thing, like I said, is really to get that CISO cert launched and really pushed out there. And once again, since you asked, not a lot of people know this, but I'm always big of you gotta put your dreams out there. Is I really want to put together a TV series on really the reality of cybersecurity and really make it fun, but raise the awareness. I look at it as the Kardashians and Vanilla Ice can have a reality TV show. Why the heck can't Dr. Cole? I mean, I got to be able to do better than that. So I like I said, I really believe my purpose is to make cyberspace safe. And I sort of want to be like in the 70s, the Ralph Nader of cybersecurity, really raising that awareness. So I just want to get a lot more out there and available to people to just help them understand the dangers and practical ways they can protect and secure themselves.
Yeah, I love that. We, Mike and I are big pop culture nerds. So one of the last questions we always ask is kind of what's your favorite cyber related movie? If you don't have one of those, just what's your favorite movie? We're big movie nerds, TV nerds, kind of, I'd say 70s, 80s, 90s, and today pop culture nerds in a way. And so I would love to see a cybersecurity related program like The Office.
Yeah.
Or where that's a mockumentary style or whatever, but you had The Office and the IT Crowd, which I love those shows, and Parks and Rec and stuff. And I feel like one around cybersecurity could be so much fun. I would love to. Yeah. You're talking about a reality show. I'm talking about scripted TV, but both would be fun for sure.
Yeah. Because it's one of those things where everyone I talk to and every time I give presentations, I mean, people think cybersecurity is so fascinating and amazing. I just don't know why Hollywood has done such an awful job. Right. With movies and stuff, even though it has my girlfriend in it. She doesn't know she's my girlfriend yet, but she is. Angelina Jolie, the movie Hackers. I mean, come on, man. That was like the sort of worst ever move. I mean, it was like, come on, that's the best you could do.
we were talking to, and I'm, this is my name drop for the podcast, but it's only because it's podcast related. Troy Hunt, who's the, you know, password pwned guy, and really interesting guy, Aussie. Yeah. And he brought up Swordfish because of Hugh Jackman being an Aussie. And I was like, that is literally one of the worst hacker movies I've ever seen. I think Swordfish might be worse than Hackers.
Yeah, I think I would definitely put there. However, and why not just take this thing in a real bad direction? But anybody that can hack a computer system,
yep,
while something interesting is happening to them, that's pretty cool, right? But the rest of the movie was awful.
I can't remember if that was the scene where he guessed like the password. He just guessed a password and got in. You know, it's like, it's a little ridiculous. I did think some of the. Did you watch Mr. Robot? That's a favorite of mine.
Mr. Robot, I actually thought started really good with the first season.
Yes.
And then like it went really demonic weird. And weird and dark. And I'm just like, huh? I'm like, you had like such a perfect play, like to have one of the best cyber series on the planet. And I don't know what happened there. They just screwed that one up.
But early on when you know, Rami Malek's character was doing the, you know, the open source intelligence collection and like looking at people's profiles and kind of creating the profile of everyone in his life. There was really good kind of cybersecurity related activity. There wasn't a whole lot of, you know, three-dimensional graphics that were showing him hacking. It was literally command line stuff they were showing. So it was like, oh, these are real commands too. Like if you look at what he's doing. So I thought it was really good in the beginning, but then you're right. It kind of went downhill quick. Well, I liked it, but not for the cybersecurity. Like I stayed with it, but for different reasons, because once I was in the story, it was good. And yeah, the whole like, you know, eco-terrorism and global economic, you know, or corporate terrorism and all that stuff got a little bit much for me. but it was still, that was a pretty good one early on for sure. So what is your favorite? Is Hackers your favorite? It sounds like it.
No. I mean, my favorite, it's old school.
Okay.
Is definitely Sneakers.
Man, it's like a consensus.
We did a review of Sneakers over the summer. Because Mike and I felt like, and Eric and Jim on our team had never seen it. And so we're like, oh, we're definitely going to introduce you to Sneakers. And every time we have a chat going on, our listeners can't see it, but it is, it's like 5 out of 8 people we've asked that question, say Sneakers is the best. I mean, and we agree. I mean, it's one of my favorites by far for sure.
Yeah. The other one, which I'll probably lose credibility after that, but the other one I actually did like, and just because it had an entertaining twist, even though it was ridiculous and over the top, is Live Free or Die Hard.
It's a fire sale. Like Bruce Willis. It's a fire sale.
I know. It's a fire sale. I mean, because what I liked about that movie was, and my kids were so embarrassed because we went to the movie theater. And to me, it was a comedy. I never laughed so hard at my. I mean, it was just so ridiculously bad that it made it good. Like they just went so ridiculous that it actually was entertaining.
Well, I mean, it is a Die Hard movie, right?
Like, yeah.
Die Hard being one of the greatest Christmas films of all time, you know, right? And so I'm with you. I like that movie just fine. I don't know. Was it Justin Long? Was he the one that played?
Yeah, Justin Long was the hacker.
And I'm also a big, well, like the bad guy was Tim Olyphant, which I'm a big fan of his, right? Like I like his brooding character in just about everything. Like, I don't know if you watched The Good Place. There was a great scene where he shows up as himself because one of the you know, eternal judges just finds him dreamy. So she like conjures him up. And I was like, you know what? She's right. He is pretty dreamy. And I like anything he's in. And he played a great kind of bad guy in that, you know?
Yeah, he's a good evil dude. Yep, I like it.
Yeah, I'm a big Tim Olyphant fan too. So that I like that one. No cred lost in our book anyway. Now that our listeners made.
Exactly. They might be like,
but we have about as many listeners as you have read that certain book, 18, 19. No, we have a few more than that. But so I certainly appreciate your view into pop culture. And if your TV show ever gets going, don't hesitate to reach out for Mike and I. We'll be glad to consult on the production and to chat about it with you for sure.
Definitely. I'll definitely take you up on that. No. And if you guys are definitely on campus, I'll have my son swing by and just say hi one of these days.
Yeah, absolutely. You should reach out. And if you ever make it to West Lafayette, we'd welcome a visit, sit down and talk shop some more for sure.
Okay, sounds like a plan.
So, Eric, thanks for joining. I think this was a fun conversation. Very interesting. I think your background is exactly, you know, kind of the types of guests our listeners want to hear from. So thanks for taking the time today.
My pleasure, and thanks for having me. This was a blast, and I had a good time.
All right, thanks. And to our listeners, as always, thank you for tuning in with us. If you want to reach out to us, you know how to get a hold of us, cybertappodcast@purdue.edu. Thanks again, Eric. Thanks, Mike.